All right, so tonight's class is a secular approach to dying as opposed to discussion of the Buddhist stages such as the bardo, etc. And my objective is to help people in the class kind of understand some of the signs and symptoms that you may observe if you're with someone who's dying, in the process of dying. Also, as they begin their transition, which can actually start at a much earlier stage, as people begin to transition, they may actually start weeks before they actually physically begin to transition. And that can come through expression of various desires or dreams or observations that may seem unnerving to you, but can be completely normal for the person who's preparing to begin that transition. So on the first page, just so we have this in order, because I'm sorry I didn't number these, I have stages of dying, and then the second page, what you can do. And on the third page, I have graphs here that discuss and show the various types of breathing patterns that you might be observing. Okay, so we're going to start with number one. And if you have questions, feel free to ask. I will leave plenty of time for questions. And then I have a couple stories I might share with you if we have some time for them. And just so you know, my background is hospice volunteer. So I have been working with patients who have been given usually up to 6 months of life left. And then also in what's called vigil, which is sitting with them when they have entered the active process of dying. We call it transition.
Excuse me. Yeah. So could I ask a question right off the bat?
Sure.
Because it looks like it applies to number one. Okay, the last two people that I was with in the last stages over the past year, they seem to expect to go into asleep or a coma.
Right.
One was under sedation, so every time she woke up and she was ready to go back to sleep again or something, she'd say goodbye to people as if it was the last time.
Yeah.
So I had a chance to talk to her before on one of those going off, but she did last like another week, but every time she, you know, went into sleep, she thought it would be the last time.
Right.
And she didn't go through, from what I could see, you know, a number of the other quite noticeable things. But I tried to talk to her about the what would happen during her being asleep. So if you could say something about what you could anticipate a person who goes into a sedation because of a drug. I think she was starting to take morphine.
Okay, so explain what she would experience,
or well, she was expecting to go peacefully,
right?
And I think the narcotics kind of desensitize her. But I'm wondering how you would see it.
Well, I think that's a very personal decision about whether or not to have narcotics. So some people prefer them right off the bat, and some people, depending upon their views, may refuse painkillers of any sort. They can put you asleep or desensitize you, as the case may be. And that can mask some symptoms and also cause some symptoms that might not otherwise be there. And that can be confusing to somebody who's in the transition process because they may not feel like they're aware of where they are in the dying process. And then again, even if somebody has no medication whatsoever, they can go in various parts of the dying process and then pull right out and go back in. So it's kind of like what I touch on here later, which is the grief process, grieving. It's not a very clear thing. It's not like you go step A, step B, step C, D. You could bypass any of those. You can go right into one and stay there. You can go back and forth. So just 2 weeks ago, my mother-in-law passed. But a few days before that, She was, as I believe, she was actually in the dying process. She began it. And then she heard that her children and grandchildren were coming to visit her, and she came right out. Mm-hmm. And for like a good week, would you say, after that, fully aware, fully alert, you know, communicating, moving, even getting up and walking around. And then after everyone had come in to see her, went back into the dying process. And then this time fully transitioned. So, and we hear about those, they're called the last hurrah, where, and the last hurrah can last minutes, where somebody just suddenly becomes very aware, or can last weeks. So I have to emphasize, as we go through this, there is no guarantee of any of these stages, and everyone's dying can be somewhat unique in its pattern. Okay, so I'm just here to tell you some of the things that I've personally witnessed or that are known to happen, so that if you witness them yourself, you're not confused or concerned. Okay?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Sure. Did I answer your question?
Okay? Yeah.
Okay. All right, so the first thing you may notice with somebody who is nearing the end of their time is that they may begin to withdraw from loved ones. They may seem to kind of go inside themselves. Like again, this is not everybody. Some people want a party. but some people can go right inside themselves and feel it. And it feels like they're cutting you out, like they are. They don't even know you're there. And that don't take that personally. When people look right through you, that's okay. That can be a typical sign of them beginning the process. They may refuse to eat and also refuse liquids. And that can be also a significant sign. When people refuse liquids, usually because they're having difficulty processing the liquids, and that's usually a sign that they have actively entered the dying process. Sometimes the person has a sense of waiting for somebody or something to happen. There may be, somebody may say something such as, I need to go on a trip. I'm supposed to go on, get on the airplane. Where's my baggage? And they have some anxiety over the fact that they can't find their baggage or that they're missing their passport. That's basically them translating, like in a dream, translating this understanding that they're beginning to enter a process and they need to go somewhere. And so what we do as we sit with these people is to assure them and tell them it's okay, your baggage is all set, we found everything, and your passport is all set, it's cleared, everything is ready for you. When you're ready to go, it's all set. So the key thing here is that wherever they are, you want to be in their space. You don't want to correct them. If they look...
You can't go on a trip now, you're really sick.
That's right. That's right. And you don't want to look at the... If they look right at you and they say, how's the baby? And you don't have a baby? And they're absolutely waiting for you to tell them.
Baby's doing fine.
You say the baby's doing fine. Baby is completely fine. You just reassure them.
My father-in-law kept packing his suitcase.
Yes. Yeah.
It's just endless. It's been every yes. day. Every morning he'd pack his suitcase.
Literally or figuratively?
Literally.
Yep.
Packed his suitcase.
Yes. Yes. He was handling his idea that he was going on a trip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it would have been better to leave the suitcase packed.
Whatever he needs. If he needs to do that ritual every morning to get some sense mm-hmm. of preparation, then maybe you should unpack it. If he just sees that it's packed and ready to go, that might ease his anxiety. So I would check in with him and find out what is it you need.
It's a little late.
Yeah, but it may happen with somebody in the future. You can also witness something called terminal agitation, and that's where somebody can be fidgety. That they may tug at, if they're hooked up to some tubes, they may feel like they have to tug at tubes, and they may feel agitated about being hooked up or in a bed. They may even have mood swings and be combative. So don't worry about it. That's not you know, anything indicative of them. It's a normal state for when you begin to transition. I covered the number three, the last hurrah. Literally, you can have people entering the whole set, the whole series of dying stages, and then open up their eyes and look right at you and go, "Hey, I'm hungry. Can I have a hamburger?" And you can go get, and so this is the person who turned away food and water. And you go get them a hamburger, and they'll eat, and they'll chat, and they'll make some phone calls. And then 3 hours later, they close their eyes, and they're dead. Just, it's fascinating the variances that can happen.
They'll actually eat?
Yes, yeah. All I can tell you is there's almost nothing predictable about dying. I've heard some amazing stories. You have the people who are perfectly alert and aware, close their eyes, let out a breath, they're gone. They don't go through any stages. So everything I'm covering here, take it with a great big grain of salt, okay? The key thing to know is that there's so many varieties and none of them are wrong, okay? Number four, seeing or talking to people who are not there, confusing people who are there with someone else. If somebody opens their eyes, looks at you and said, "I had a wonderful dinner with my husband last night," and their husband passed away. So what you say is, you don't say, "Well, Dad passed away already."
Oh, what'd you guys have?
What'd you guys have for dinner? What'd you talk about? So I had a patient when I came to visit him 3 days before he passed. I sat down next to him and he told me about a visit he had from his brother. And as he's talking about his brother, I realized this brother had died 3 years ago. It was the one brother had died. And I asked him, "So what'd you guys talk about?" And he said, "You know, he just sat there for the longest time looking at me." And then he said, I said to him, "I love you." And he said, "I know." And that was it. That was the only discussion. And then he got up and left. And I said, "Is there anything else you'd like to say to him?" At that point, he looked at me and he said, "You know that brother's dead." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You don't think I'm going crazy?" I said, "Not at all. I think you're about to go on undertake a journey where your living loved ones can't join you right now. And so those loved ones who've gone on before you are coming to let you know it's okay." And he just kind of considered that for a while, and he said, "So you don't think I'm going crazy?" And I said, "So if I couldn't see the color green because I'm colorblind, and you could, and you were trying to describe green to me, would it be fair for me to say you're crazy?" And he said, "No." And I said, "You're not crazy." He goes, "But
yeah,
nobody..."
Do you talk about death?
Do I talk about death?
Yeah, did you say you're preparing to die?
I don't know. I follow him. If he wants to talk about dying, then I will talk about dying.
Oh, let him say.
Right. So in this stage, he was getting the idea that he was there, but he wanted to talk about the visit of his brother. So all I said is, "You're going about to go on a journey," and because that was the term he had used up till then. And so it made him feel at ease because he realized he wasn't going crazy. So I told him, next time his brother visits, have at it. Talk about whatever you want to. And don't worry if anyone else here in the room doesn't see him and says something like, who are you talking to? You don't have to explain yourself. So
has anyone seen Angels in America?
Yeah. Is that a movie?
It's a play. Well, it's also, HBO made it.
It's now on Broadway again.
There's wonderful scenes where Roy Cohn is lying in his hospital bed, and Ethel Rosenberg, who was executed, is sitting there blaming him.
Oh wow! Yeah,
it's intense.
It's just classic.
Yeah.
Of talking to somebody.
Yeah.
When you're gonna die.
Yes. Yeah.
I had a friend who said his father had someone who visited, like the father was an extended time that he was dying. Every day, the guy's here again today.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, Dad.
Yeah. There'll be people who will look right in a corner and see a shadow in the corner. And they'll just say, there's somebody sitting in the corner over there. Mm. And so what you can say is, what does it feel like? What does it feel like an okay presence? And then talk about that with them. You don't have to try to define the person. Let them define it. But the most important thing is, how do they feel about that? Do they feel, you know, a comment that I've heard before is, I feel like they're waiting. What are they waiting for? Just try to get them to talk about what's going on inside of them so that they can share their story with you.
I can ask, most of the patients, however you say, describe them, are at this last stage. Mm-hmm. Are most of them clear, or are most of them sedated?
So you talk about in the actual transition process, or the weeks up to it?
I would say the last stage before passing away.
So I've had one patient who was very alert right up until about 3 hours before he passed, and then he went into the breathing stages and went inside himself. I've had quite a few who were non-responsive. They were just into themselves for, you know, inside themselves for the most part. The breathing patterns become, in my experience, very typical, and we'll discuss that in a minute. So I haven't had anybody who I've been with who just passed, except one person who didn't pass in hospice. When I was 17, a friend of mine died in front of me, and he died from a heart condition, and he didn't go through any of these stages. He did let out what's called a death rattle, and this, unfortunately, was while I was performing CPR on him. So it's different for everybody, but I typically, when I've been present at end of life, there's the breathing pattern that happens, and if, especially if they're sedated and on morphine or other painkillers.
Mm-hmm. When my mother was dying, they gave her morphine to help with her breathing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because she was having the rattling, and they gave her the morphine to calm that down.
Yeah, yep. And there are other medications as well now. So it can, especially if somebody's having a great deal of difficulty feeling like they're not getting enough air, then morphine can help relax the body enough to help them feel like they're getting enough oxygen. Moving on to number 5, you may notice some skin mottling and gray or blue fingernails, and that's usually because the oxygen is pulling back out of the bloodstream for the appendages. And then number 6, and again, this is in general, when the heartbeat is up to 120 beats a minute regularly, then death will likely happen within days to a week. So that's another symptom you might see, and some people may not have that symptom. Okay. Number 7, the breathing patterns. So now if you go onto the last page, you'll see the different types of breathing patterns we have. So if you look at normal respiration, you have your in and out. And then biot's respiration is you have a deeper intake and output, and then you have a pause. So this is breathing, breathing, pause, no breathing at all, and then big breath in and breathing and breathing and breathing. So it can actually be very disconcerting because it may seem like they just died, right? Because they may go absolutely still, and then they'll begin breathing again. Cusmol breathing is just a very big up and down of the breathing of the respiratory amplitude. And then chain strokes, and I've seen chain strokes a lot with people on morphine, and they can go into chain strokes respiration with morphine and still be, a ways out from the dying process. So chain strokes is where you have shallow breath in and out, slightly bigger breath, very big breath, shallower, 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 no breath, and then it starts back up again. It goes shallow breath in. So it's kind of this rhythm of, you know, building up to a big breath and then back down and then pause. and then up. So don't be concerned if the breathing stops, completely stops for a while. Okay? There's also tends to be moaning that happens with the breathing, and that's because you have relaxed vocal cords. As well, you have can have terminal, what's called terminal secretions, which is basically when all of us who are healthy, when we have cold secretions, we cough them up. They don't have the strength or the energy to cough them up, so there's a rattling sound going on. That's right. It can sound bubbly and rattly. Mm-hmm. And that can be really tough for people who don't know what that is, because the first thing that comes to mind for many witnesses is they think they're drowning. Mm-hmm. And it does not necessarily mean that there's any liquids in their lungs. It doesn't mean that they're in pain. It's just, it's a very difficult sound for us to listen to as a healthy person. And there are, yes, go ahead.
I know that small breathing, does that have to do with a lot for diabetic people? Because I noticed diabetes as mentioned.
Yes,
here.
Yeah.
So more often people who have diabetes.
And I'm not entirely certain of the exact conditions that can cause these. My only personal experience is, and it does actually say that drugs can cause the chain Stokes respiration. Because actually, as a hospice volunteer, I'm often not given the medical diagnosis for a good reason. That's HIPAA information. It's not necessary for me to be present with it. So I'm just there to be there with the person. We covered chain Stokes. And then the other thing is you might have some spasms as the body begins to shut down. Circulation gets more difficult for the body. I like to say this to the family, dying's a lot of hard work. It can be a really tough job. It's very a lot of work on the body.
It's like giving birth.
Yes, exactly. Just like giving birth is a lot of work for the baby, to go through that whole process, dying can be that way as well. So there may be times where there's spasms, the whole body can begin shaking. It's their electrolytes are off. There's a lot of things that are going on in the body. Just be present with them. Keep them from, people from getting upset, and explain that this is okay. This is part of the process. Usually a nurse or a doctor will be there to help either tell you what's going on or to address it. It might mean that they need more medication if they would desire medication. But don't be upset if that's what's happening. And then one of the most disconcerting things that can happen actually happened to me on the first transition that I was with, which is post-breathing lucidity. And this is where my patient actually, for all intents and purposes, died. Stopped all their breathing for minutes. Nurse came in, checked the heartbeat. There was no heartbeat. Pronounced dead. And I turned to the family and I said, now, I had actually heard about this, and I said to them that the hearing is the last thing to go, so you should continue to talk. But as well, there's moments when, and I swear it was right when I said when, a person can suddenly become lucid, and he opened his eyes.
Whoa.
And he looked right at his wife, and she gasped. I said, because he's not breathing, no heartbeat that we know of. And I said, now's your time to tell him what you need to tell him. And she said, I love you, and it's okay to go. And then he looked at his son, his granddaughter, and went to each person in the family, and then laid back and was gone. Mm-hmm. He just needed that last moment where there was no breathing disruption, nothing to have to interrupt him to connect with each of his family members. And I was very glad that I was there and saying that, because I had kept them present in the room so that they could witness that. And that was just happened. It just happened miraculously that I had heard about that and was explaining it. So, and there are people who are literally put on the gurney and wheeled away and heading off to the morgue, and they sit up. Oh, jeez. You know, the sheets over them, and they sit up. So you'll hear some interesting stories from a lot of hospice organizations, and they've just learned to kind of roll with it. You don't know what's going to happen. Never say, that's it, they're gone. And I always tell people, talk to them as if they're still there for a solid 2 hours mm-hmm. after they're dead, after they've been there, it's confirmed. 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Continue to talk to them and acknowledge their presence. Because even if you're not spiritual and don't believe in the spirit staying around the body for a while, the fact is that the hearing is, and the brain activity could still be going, and the hearing could still be active. Okay?
So if I could ask another
yes.
question. So with this sense of some sort of brain work going on, or mm-hmm. the body, you know, having some energy left in it, suppose you were reading with the patient during those last times. Mm-hmm. Should you keep reading or, you know, listening to music together or whatever?
Sure.
You know, continue talking as if, you know, nothing was going on, or in between talking, you know, assuring whatever stage mm-hmm. they're in, our perceptions they're mm-hmm. experiencing. You go right back to, like, reading with your...
You can do that.
Read poetry.
You can do that, yeah.
So I did that for a colleague that... someone I worked with, and he didn't have family around here. Mm-hmm. So my boss said, he's passing, and he shouldn't be by himself.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so people took two-hour shifts through,
through
the afternoon, and I did like a 4 to 6 a.m. shift that happened to be the day he died later
yeah.
that day, and we just sat and read him letters, and somebody else read something, you know, some story for him.
That's what we do in vigil. If somebody has no family in the area or just no family, we'll sit vigil with them so that they aren't alone. Yeah.
And who finally decides at the end of the vigil?
The nurse will come in and check on them and announce time of death. Once the breathing has completely stopped. If they're in a hospital or a hospice house, there's usually monitors that are going in, but they check rather regularly.
No, but you're saying all this that we were just talking about was yeah. after the breathing, so...
Yeah, yeah.
So
I'm not certain if they change the... I don't know if after, you know, if let's say an hour after they're pronounced dead and they yeah. stand back up again, yeah. what do they do in that instance? I'm not even quite sure if they, like, reassign a time of death after that. So, I don't know. I've just heard about these various things that have happened. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's obviously not... very common.
No, it's not common, but it does happen, and they want you to be aware of it so that you don't freak out, essentially, and get really upset about it. Okay? Going on to the next page, what you can do, and I've touched on some of these, be with the patient mentally wherever they are, as I've said, so set them at ease. Wherever, if they want to talk about something that makes absolutely no sense to you, just acknowledge it and stay with them. I suggest a method of mindfulness whenever possible, letting go of the judgment and creating a space for whatever happens. Don't try to go into this, and I would even add this to your own death. Please don't have in your mind, this is how I want to die, and be very specific, because you may not go that way. My suggestion is to be open. Just be open to the process. And even if you're not spiritual, I suggest this to people. Stay open and as relaxed as possible, so that whatever comes, or nothing, you're open to it. So if there is something after this, being open to it isn't going to hurt you at all. And it will only help you in the dying process itself. So one of the things when people are struggling for breath, and my husband used this with his mom, and he noticed distinctly a big difference. She was struggling for her breath, and he told her that what I had suggested, which was in between the breaths, after you let out the breath, and before you take in your next breath, there's a small gap. Rest in that gap. Just relax for a moment before you take your next breath. And he saw a distinct difference in her. He saw her begin to just relax and stop fighting, which can actually make your breathing easier. But it can also help the dying process, because some people are fighters. They will fight for every inch of their life, even right up into the very end. And sometimes helping them to relax into the process can provide quite a bit of relief and not extend the duration of any of their suffering. Different types of meditation, if you do that, includes Vipassana meditation and Shamatha when you need focus. Tonglen can be useful for short periods. Be careful doing Tonglen for too long. For those of you who are new to Tonglen, it's breathing in fear, pain, any of the negative energy, and breathing out loving kindness, peace, white breath. There are many different terms for it, but basically you're acting, I like to, the term I like to think of is you're an air conditioner. You know, you're taking in the hot and you're bringing out the cool. And just like an air conditioner, you're not holding on to the air. You're not bringing it in and holding on to it. You're actually filtering it and sending it back out.
And the filter isn't you anyway.
That's right. That's right. So, but it's a very, I find it to be a powerful practice for opening me to just softening and opening to the world and to other people. But it can also be really challenging to do something like this when you're with a dying person. I do recommend, I have a little kit myself for when I go out to be with my patients. Chapstick for dry lips. I don't bring that, the hospital has it, because you don't want to use chapstick on different patients.
Good strategy.
Yeah, right. So chapsticks for dry lips, or a cold cloth for their forehead that may be hot. They may also swab the mouth. The hospitals often have, and hospice houses have, a mixture of something, because sometimes when people are breathing, they leave their mouth open because they feel like they need to get more air, and the mouth can dry out and it can be very uncomfortable. So you can swab their mouth with this swab that will put, it's a type of moisturizer that doesn't dry out and add some comfort. If they request, read from religious texts or play religious recordings. So as a hospice volunteer, I am not Buddhist when I go there. I am whatever they need me to be. If they need me to read from a Bible, I will read from a Bible. If they need me to pray, I will pray. I'm good with that. It's like I'm there for them. Sometimes they can't tell you, especially in vigil when I come in and they're in the active process. So I kind of hunt around and look for any signs of what I can give them that might help. And I had one patient who I came in. It was a last minute. They needed me to help. The son was flying in from Cuba, and they had a span of actually it was 5 hours where there would be nobody there from 10 p.m. till 3 a.m., and I volunteered to take it. And I was looking around the room, and I saw a picture of Jesus above her bed. So I went online, and I actually found a website for Songs for Dying.
There you go.
Wow. And I downloaded some boys choir Christian music, and I played it. I have a little speaker in my iPhone, and put it right next to her pillow. And it's gorgeous boys choir music, just beautiful a cappella. And I really enjoyed it myself. And one thing that was interesting was, you know, she was in the struggling a little bit for breathing. And then Silent Night came on, and it was just a solo, one boy singing it. Mm-hmm. And it came on, and she turned her head, eyes still closed, just turned her head, and her breathing just went very soft. Mm-hmm. And for the entire duration of the song, it was just like that. Mm-hmm. And then the song ended and went on to another song, and she just turned her head back, but her breathing stayed very gentle after that. Mm-hmm. And when her son came in, bags in hand, literally Ubered right from the airport, and he gave me a big hug and he thanked me for being there. Mm-hmm. And I said, does she happen to have a soft spot for Silent Night? He said, oh, that's her favorite song. So sometimes you happen to stumble upon a situation like that where you're able to get just the right thing that they need.
So. One person I was with, she was obnoxious to, you know, all the personnel and all that. So very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. But a hospice came in, and one person was a guitarist.
Yes.
And she started singing. So I asked them to sing the Von Trapp song.
Oh, yes.
Boom, everything changed.
Yes.
And then afterwards, though, she wasn't similar to God, she went back to her old ways. But it was incredible to see the absolute change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was a relief because nobody could touch it.
Yeah.
You know, getting her out of her chaos.
Yeah. Yeah. Music therapy that hospice provides is an amazing service. That and pet therapy.
Yeah.
And massage therapy. Hospice provides a phenomenal host of services, all covered by your insurance or volunteers. And I do compassionate touch therapy, which is instead of massage, it's more like pressure points. And just having that touch on somebody can just immediately calm them down. When my mother-in-law was passing, before she began the active transition, I would give her massages, and that meant a lot to her. She couldn't speak, but she was making all kinds of noises of pleasure when I was just hitting all the sore muscles in her neck and down in her back, and I'd do her arms and her legs and wherever I could reach to just get the blood back in there and help her feel a little more relaxed and at ease. And I don't know if she's ever had a massage in her life.
Yeah. No, she's not that kind of.
Yeah, no. Check. Not the kind to sit still very long.
Not really a touchy feeling.
Yeah. Person. Except it then.
Yeah.
Very much so towards the end.
Had she been fond of you?
I'm very fond of each other. We respected each other. We didn't always see eye to eye, but we definitely, we drew the line and said, I still love you. Uh-huh. So absolutely, yeah. I admired that about her. She was able to put aside any disagreements and say, we're good. You know, she never pushed people away who she disagreed with. So, and she could disagree.
Favorite thing to do.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Basically, when you're there, you want to try just do what it takes to help the patient relax. And it might be singing, it might be playing some music, it might be reading to them. Talking, reading letters, anything that you think, and then reassure them that it is okay to go. Because sometimes people will hang in there because they're afraid of someone not being taken care of, or that something will go wrong if they leave.
Excuse me, could I ask on, there's a statement here you said, if something about leaving. If they want you, if they're waiting for you.
Yes.
That seems to be pretty subtle.
Yeah. So let me just cover these before I get to number 7.
Oh, no.
So that's okay.
Oh, I thought you were
mad. Jumping ahead a little bit. That's okay. People are dying, often want a permission to die from those that they love. And they want to be assured of, we know of these 5 things that come up most often. They want to be assured that things they were once responsible for would be taken care of. So if they were in charge of something, or if they were responsible for someone, that person or that thing is going to be taken care of.
There will be an unsay next week.
Yeah.
I'm dying.
Just in case.
But if we make you do this for next 4 years.
They want to know the survivors will survive without them, that we will go on. They want to know that all is forgiven. Because a lot of people will hold things in their hearts, the things that they've done and that they regret. They want to know that their life had meaning and that they mattered. And they want to know they will be remembered. And being remembered means that they don't want to feel like they're going to go extinct, that's it. So you want to let them know that you carry them you will carry them inside of you from here on. They're not gone. They're just inside of you, in your heart space. Okay? So those are five things you can help people a lot by just reassuring them of that.
Can I ask something on this? Just last week, my sister called me up. And the first and third ones, she was practically crying over.
Yeah.
So I began to think in terms of, you know, she must think she's dying. But she wanted to make sure all her debts were forgiven.
Yes.
And was everything taken care of?
Yes. Yeah.
And you know, she's been very sick for the past, you know, who knows, 5 to 10 years, but it's a chronic thing that we all get used to.
Yes.
But it seems to me she was especially upset last week.
I had a patient who was a World War II vet, and thankfully I had him for a good 6 months, because about a month into my visits with him, I was told he never talks about the war. And so I never broached the subject with him. But there was one time I came to visit him, and he just started talking about something he witnessed in the war. And he witnessed this individual do something that was pretty extreme. And he paused and said, "Well, what do you think about that?" And I said, you know, I actually answered as honestly as I could. I said, "I cannot judge that person, because I can tell you that it's very hard to remain humane in an inhumane situation such as war." So I imagine that he must have been in a lot of pain to do what he did. And he said, "Oh, okay." He thought about it. You know, he had some, what I felt to be some pretty harsh judgment on the individual. So we just dropped it, and that was it. We went on to talk about cars after that. And then the next week I came back, and he told me the same exact story, only this time he was the individual. So he needed to see that I wouldn't judge him for what he did, that I could accept and understand that we all do terrible things at times. And so from that point on, he unloaded a lot about the war. And it was really good, because for months he unpacked things he had never told another soul. And these were stories that he needed to give to somebody else, to let go of. Mm-hmm. And I was very honored to be in that position and to hear those stories from him. So a big part of being present with people is not judging. And even when they tell you something about somebody else, they may actually be trying to tell you about something they did. So abstaining from judgment, and perhaps even expressing compassion, or even just saying, "How do you feel about that, about what that person did?" can have them express what they're feeling about themselves. And even that's enough to help people unload. The next one, number six, tell the patient what you're doing if you need to move their body, and identify yourself when you come into the room. So even if they seem to be asleep or in the active process of dying, they don't seem to be aware, when I come in, I always come up to the bed, I touch their hand, I say, "I'm Megan, I'm here as your visitor," and then I explain, you know, "I'm going to play some music, or I'm going to read to you, or I'm just going to sit here and be with you." If I'm going to, sometimes I'll put moisturizer on their hands, and I'll explain what I'm doing. If there's any reaction from them, I'll ask them, "Do you want me to swab your mouth," or anything, and I don't do any of that unless I get a reaction from them. If I'm getting up to leave, if I have to go to the bathroom or leave the room, I tell them, "I'm just heading out, I'll be back in 15 minutes, or if I'm going out for dinner, I'll be back in an hour." And that's important. It's important because some people don't want to die with anyone in the room. And so hospice are actually trained to take a break and let them know. Because there are a lot of people who feel deep regret that they spent days with their family member, and the moment they walked out to go to get a sandwich, the person died, and they felt such guilt. And I always tell them, don't.
Yeah, my mother-in-law was like,
yes.
It was like my brother-in-law and sister-in-law had been there, and they both had to go do something, and they left. And that's when she died, because she never liked to bother anybody.
Yes.
I don't want to be a bother.
Yes. They may even specifically say to you, you need to go now. Please leave. And they may even get kind of harsh with you. And it may feel like, oh my God, what did I do? It's not you. It's not you. They may be preparing to die, and they don't want you there for whatever reason. And it's okay.
Yeah, my brother did for me.
Yeah.
I told him I was leaving to get something at the sink.
Yeah.
Came back in.
Yeah. Good for you for telling him you were leaving. You gave him that opportunity.
Yeah, we are.
You gave him what he needed.
It was in the mid-morning. It was in a...
Yeah.
Just, you know, all that time of morning.
Yeah. Number eight, continually talking quietly about good memories and as if the person was present even after the heart has stopped. I covered that a few minutes ago. There are, in this state of Massachusetts, there are home funeral options. You can actually hold the funeral in your own house if you so desire. If you wish to pursue that, it's a great discussion to have with a person who may have a prognosis that goes out a few months. So that means that when the person has fully died, there will be no morgue to come in and whisk the body away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You will actually be allowed, there's certain things you need to do to keep the body preserved cool, to keep it cool. And
turn down the heat.
You can also get ice packs, cooling packs.
We talked to someone from our church.
Yes.
Did that, Susan Brown.
She was out on the porch.
She was out on the porch. That's great. She lived, she had a house right on the river,
that's
and it was
great.
Beautiful. She was like on a couch that she used to lie on to look out at the river.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So the family had her on the porch with the ice. I think Mark helped.
And people came and sat with her.
Yes.
And they said,
for like days.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah, and you have days.
It was amazing to sit with her.
Yes.
I mean, she'd been dead for at least a whole day.
It gives you immense closure to be able to take that time.
That's
instead of in a hospital where you have maybe an hour or two, you can have days to say goodbye.
But you can keep someone at home and then have a standard funeral. Like I think I had a friend who kept her husband home for a day or two.
Yes. Yeah. But don't confuse that. I mean, there will be actually people say that's not legal. Yes, it is in this state. It's absolutely legal and in many other states. So just know your rights ahead of time and talk to law enforcement and talk to other people, because you need to make sure that everyone is aware of what's going on. And you don't call 911 to say that the person has passed, but you let them be aware ahead of time. And then in that case,
how do you declare the person dead?
Hospice can still take care of that. They can still, they will be there and help you with that process.
If you don't have hospice, what if you're just at home?
Generally, you do have to notify some authorities that this has happened. So you can notify the police or the hospital or even the morgue. The key thing is to communicate this ahead of time. Make arrangements ahead of time so no one's surprised. So that you know who to contact.
You can't always plan dying, but...
Well, this is for when you know that this is what you want and this is what you're preparing for. The other thing is green burials. That's becoming slowly more popular. Green burials, so that there's no chemicals put into your body, and often there's not even a wooden casket. They now have cardboard caskets. Sometimes people opt to be just wrapped in a cloth and put right into the ground.
They're in a concrete enclosure, though.
Not necessarily. So there are actually some towns that will allow you to bury on your own property. as long as GPS coordinates are filed with the town.
Oh, so when the people who buy your house in 10 years dig up your body.
And by the way, yes. The Johnson family is to your left.
That's right.
It's permanent. Huh?
So you can talk to your town. You might have to file for a permit. You might have to go through some stages. But some towns will actually allow you to bury a loved one on your own property. Uh-huh. You can go through the process of cremation. Thank you. Ashes. The reason I would prefer green burial over that is that it actually takes a great deal of fossil fuel to burn up a body, because they have to have it hold it at a certain temperature for a very long time. And somebody calculated that's a trip across the United States 3 times in an airplane.
Uh-huh. I won't ever tell my friend that.
Yeah. So it's. I would prefer just. I want to go right in the ground and put the earth on me after a Viking funeral.
You got the boat made?
I want to rave a big bonfire and party.
And some fire breathing.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Megan will sit up. Your mom will sit up and fire breathe. Frank, where's the mic? That would be pretty. That would probably be one of a kind.
She's going to dance.
The last point before mourning process is self-care for the caregiver. So throughout this entire process, you're going to want to make sure that you're refilling what I call your E-tank. This is not my term. I stole it from coaching, which stands for emotional tank. And your E-tank can be on empty. And you need to take care of yourself. And sometimes that means, yes, you may have signed up to go be with somebody that day, and you don't have it in you. And that's okay. It's okay to refill that E-tank before you go be there for somebody. So take some time out and take care of yourself. That might be a bubble bath or go to the gym or do some art or whatever you need to help refill your E-tank, because it takes a lot out of you to be with somebody dying. It's facing our own mortality right there. So be kind to yourself, and not just there in the dying process, well after it. Also consider therapy. Ask for assistance from family and hospice. You don't have to do it alone. That's what hospice is for. And then there's the mourning process. And please note that I have here does not progress neatly from one to the other. Okay? So the 5 standard points are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And you can literally jump around from each one of those. That you can start with depression, go to bargaining, go down to acceptance, and then go back up to denial. So it may seem like, you know, they were so full of acceptance just yesterday, and now they're in denial. That's normal. It's okay. There's nothing predictable about the process.
Who are you talking about? You're saying the patient is denying?
So if there's a sudden death in the family, the very first thing that most people feel is denial.
So it's after death.
Yeah. It can be upon.
That's how we're feeling.
It can be on. It can help be for us, or it can be for a person who's just been told you have a month left to live.
Yeah.
They can actually go through. This is the mourning process, the grieving process. Mm-hmm. So it could actually be them saying, "Oh no," and they go through denial, and then they could be angry about it, and then there's the bargaining. And that comes from like, well, if I do this, maybe I can get this. And God, if you spare my life, I promise you this. So there's this whole kind of trying to bargain and to change the outcome. And then you can go through depression, and you may come to acceptance, and then you may jump right back up to denial again. So it's messy. That's what I want to say over and over again about this, is it's very messy. We may have all these notes that can kind of help you identify what's going on at that moment, but it doesn't mean you know what's going to go on the next moment. Okay? Mm-hmm. You just really got to be open to whatever's coming down the line.
So actually, I had a question I was thinking about that. When I went to visit my colleague in the hospital, I went with a younger colleague who was a little bit high-strung person.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think how what's useful if you're just going with someone else who maybe is less comfortable. Mm-hmm. What's in terms of helping them be there in a way that's at least helpful to the other person and mm-hmm. maybe helpful to them. Yeah. Like what do you, I mean, you think sort of saying like just be with that person. But I think, I guess for her also, she was younger enough that it wasn't, it may not have been something she really thought about or dealt with. Like, I don't know that she'd had family members die or,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
So I'm just, I mean.
So it might be good to cover some of these points. Take this print out with you. And
yeah.
kind of go through it with them. And so that they have, usually when people have some sense of these possible things could happen, and by the way, they also could not happen, and anything could happen, and it's okay, just stay open to it. Giving them some sense, and also they're going to cue into you and see how you handle it.
Yeah.
But by just having some sense of what they could possibly see, can help.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that there was someone else who was a dear friend of the man and a dear friend of hers who was there, and I think that sort of helped her.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking now, like, why did I go with her? Like, she's, but if she had, she taught with me, but she'd gone to the high school and this man had been her teacher.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So she really wanted to go, and it's like, so I went with her.
Yeah,
that's
great. Well, she probably needed somebody to go with her.
Well, no, but it was also, we were going to Uphill Hospital for a 4 a.m. shift. Yeah. I didn't want to drive in there by myself either.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I mean, just I'm thinking about now who she is. That like.
Yeah. I talk beforehand, you know. It's good if you know the state they're in so that you can give them a heads up.
Yeah, I mean, I think we didn't realize, like,
right.
I didn't know when we were there, and I realized when we got there, like, there's not much longer, and it really was within 5 hours.
So, yeah, and what you might do is check in with the nurses beforehand and say, we're here to visit so-and-so. Can you let me know before we go in what should we expect to witness?
Yeah.
And they can kind of clue you in so that you don't go in and go, whoa, you know, and just feel, like, totally pushed back on your heels.
Yeah. No, he was, I mean, because it was, the breathing was, was really challenging.
Yes, it is. That's the number one thing I hear from family members. The breathing is the hardest thing for them to work with.
And then we kept saying, we keep trying to push his morphine button, and she's like, yeah, you're not allowed to do that.
Megan, a friend of mine died many years ago, and her friends were taught a technique, I don't know if this is still done, but we were taught that to be with her, it helps to breathe with her.
Hmm.
To match her breathing.
Huh. I've never heard of that. That's kind of like what you do when you help
calming.
People give birth.
Yeah.
I think it might be challenging if they're in Cosmol or
I don't think you could do it.
Yeah, or the Chain-Stokes breathing. That might be pretty difficult to do.
Yeah.
But if
it might be,
if they're not in that process.
It might be disturbing to them for a friend to be copying the breathing.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. But you know what? If somebody seems, if you try it and it seems to help them.
It did.
Then there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. So sometimes just doing things like that. I have accidentally stumbled upon things over and over again that just happen to work, you know, not drastic things, but just, you know, small things like playing that Silent Night, you know, you just, wow, and what a difference it made. So just trying subtle things like that, massaging someone's hand or putting on lotion, sometimes just human touch alone, even if you have nothing to say, just holding their hand, just touching them, putting a cold cloth on their forehead so that they know somebody is there with them. That can be enough. What's that?
The stuffed owl.
Yeah. The girls got the grandma a stuffed owl. And when she got into terminal agitation, she hit somebody with it. But she had this stuffed owl that she always wanted to know where it was. And she put it over here and she'd reach over and touch it. And I know I saw her one time just checking the beak and everything, because she couldn't see. So she was, that stuffed owl was very important to her. She loved it.
She didn't hit one of you guys with it.
No. But that was, you know, you never know what the thing is that's going to help them.
It was interesting, when my mom was in a nursing home right around Christmas this year, I went up to see her, and her roommate actually was in the dying process.
Yeah.
And, like, her minister had rushed, and then she didn't have anyone there for a little bit. And one of the people at the home, they just put their phone next to her and picked out, like, music and had it play for her.
Yeah.
Until the battery ran down, pretty much, just to have... Because she'd been a choir director and organist at church. It's like, she just loved music, so she said, just, we'll just play.
Yeah. Yeah. One woman I read, Laura Ingalls, she just was so passionate about Laura Ingalls and Little House on the Prairie, so I read to her from that as she died. So it is end of class, so we're going to go through the ending.